The first major test of the biodefenders' clout came only a few months later when the administration debated whether to destroy the world's last known remaining stocks of the smallpox virus. The destruction of smallpox seemed an easy call. Eradication of smallpox had been one of the great achievements in the history of public health. The last known outbreak of the disease had occurred in Somalia in 1977, and 3 years later, the World Health Organization had formally declared the disease eradicated. In 1996, WHO's governing body had recommended the destruction of the last remaining stocks, which were under tight security at two places, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta and Vector, Lev Sendakchev's institute in Siberia. The target date for destruction was June 2000. But Russian and American intelligence analysts believed that other countries maintained hidden stocks of the virus. Sendakchev had said he was certain that North Korea, among other countries, was secretly keeping smallpox, and American analysts shared his view. Pentagon officials argued that a public ceremony announcing the elimination of the smallpox virus would be a charade. First, WHO had had no means to determine whether all countries had carried out their pledges to destroy existing stocks or transfer the virus to WHO repositories. It had simply accepted national declarations. Second, Pentagon officials believed that several nations, including American allies, had also secretly decided to maintain clandestine stocks. Even if every country was smallpox-free, the deadly virus might be recreated from related microbes if a country wanted to make new stocks. Smallpox, they argued, was simply too tempting a weapon to abandon. Finally, they argued, destroying the Russian and American stocks would complicate efforts to develop a new vaccine and antiviral drugs against the disease. America's population, which had not been vaccinated against smallpox since 1972, was particularly vulnerable. If the contagious virus was used in a terrorist attack, one expert said, we are all Indians, a reference to the devastating effects smallpox had on the Native American populations after European settlers had arrived. President Clinton was under heavy political pressure from arms control advocates and other largely Democratic constituencies to proceed with the destruction of the virus anyway, as a moral statement and a political example to the world. Respected scientists such as Donald A. Henderson, a former White House science advisor who had led the campaign to destroy the virus, argued that scientists did not need the actual virus to develop a new vaccine. His view was finding a sympathetic audience among many administration officials and in many developing countries. Lederberg and other opponents of destruction realized that they would have to marshal compelling arguments in order to secure a stay of execution for the virus. Fortunately for their cause, they had an ally in the White House, an effective bureaucrat with impeccable scientific credentials who happened to head an office in the National Security Council that Clinton had established to evaluate issues of public health and national security. For Kenneth Bernard, a physician who had served as Assistant Surgeon General before assuming the new White House post, the correct position was a no-brainer, as he had told friends in the biodefense community. In addition to concerns about Iraq and North Korea, Bernard knew that Ken Alibek had warned that the Soviets had weaponized smallpox and that the Russians might still be keeping genetically modified stocks for use in weapons. Of course, the destruction of the virus had to be postponed, Bernard believed, but building the case would not be easy. After all, the administration had initially favored the destruction in 1996 and now would be reversing itself. Realizing that Clinton would want to rely on expert scientific opinion and knowing that one of the nation's leading smallpox experts, Donald Henderson, fervently favored destruction, Bernard asked the National Academy of Sciences to form a committee to study the issue. Rather than ask the panel whether the virus should be kept or destroyed, Bernard persuaded the Academy to explore whether critical treatment advances would be lost if the virus were destroyed. The framing of the issue proved decisive. In March 1999, the panel concluded that such opportunities might indeed be sacrificed if the virus were eliminated. Proponents of destruction were furious, knowing that they were surely likely to lose the argument, at least for now. A month later, Clinton announced that the United States would fight to delay destruction when the WHO assembly met in Geneva in May. With Russia and the United States in agreement, the world reluctantly followed. WHO decided to postpone destroying the stocks until at least 2002. Bernard, Lederberg, and their allies had won an important round. Defenders. Near the end of a hot, dry summer on August 23, 1999, Deborah S. Asness, an infectious disease specialist at Flushing Hospital Medical Center, called the New York City Health Department with some distressing news. Two elderly patients had come in with symptoms that seemed to be caused by a neurological illness: fever, muscle weakness, and confusion. Both the New York State Department of Health and the Centers for Disease Control were alerted to the cases. Just over a month later, on September 27th, the CDC officially confirmed that a West Nile-like virus was responsible for these infections. Eventually, the virus would sicken 62 people and 7 patients would die. The finding was astonishing. West Nile had never caused an epidemic in the Western Hemisphere. The discovery unnerved many biodefense scientists and government officials who saw the New York outbreak as a dress rehearsal for a terrorist attack, a test of how well public health officials would cope with the sudden spread of a disease not typically found in the United States. Many felt that the summer's events highlighted several weaknesses in the nation's network for detecting emerging diseases. The public health system had performed well in many respects. An alert physician had reported the cluster of mysterious illnesses to the authorities, who in turn had quickly identified the virus's likely vector as mosquitoes. The city had also taken swift action to stop the virus's spread, despite the initial misdiagnosis. The spraying of insecticide had contained the outbreak of the globe-hopping virus among humans. Because of the city's investment in bioterrorism defense, local public health and emergency preparedness officials knew one another and had worked together fairly well. But the incident revealed some disturbing weaknesses. The daily conference calls involving as many as 100 officials from 18 different local, state, and federal agencies, often lasting up to 2 hours, left officials less time to deal with the crisis. In jurisdictional disputes, it was sometimes unclear which agency in which city, state, or county was in charge. Although the outbreak was relatively small, a study by the General Accounting Office, Congress's independent auditing arm, concluded that it had severely strained the resources of one of the country's largest, most experienced urban public health departments. If a relatively modest, naturally occurring epidemic had done that to the public health system of New York City, what would happen if a broader epidemic erupted elsewhere in the nation? The medical inquiry had also strained the federal government's limited lab resources. The GAO and a Senate committee inquiry also concluded that the CDC had failed to abide by one of its own mottos in disease surveillance and control: expect the unexpected. In testing samples from the initial victims, the CDC scientists had screened for only 6 viruses common in this country. They had not tested for several that had been linked to foreign epidemics or germ warfare, among them West Nile. To White House officials, the missteps in tracking the West Nile virus were but one example of the practical difficulties they faced throughout the government as they struggled to turn President Clinton's broad commitment to germ defense into practical reality. Clinton's enthusiasm for the issue had translated into growing budgets for biodefense, and federal agencies were eagerly competing for their share. But no one had overall authority over how the money was spent. Biodefense crossed every imaginable line in the government, sprawling across the Defense Department, Justice Department, Central Intelligence Agency, Department of Health and Human Services, and Federal Emergency Management Agency. It was what one veteran of the Clinton administration would later call an orphan mission, managed by everyone and no one. The Pentagon's effort to vaccinate American troops against anthrax ran into new difficulties in 1999. At military bases around the country, several hundred soldiers had refused orders to take the vaccine. A tiny percentage of the 200,000 servicemen inoculated in the initial phase of the program. The cases were nonetheless high profile, and the military moved to court-martial soldiers who resisted. Mark Zaid, a lawyer who represented some of the first soldiers to refuse the shots, had obtained thousands of pages of documents through his Freedom of Information Act lawsuit. Some undercut the government's categorical assertions about the vaccine's safety and efficacy. Zaid issued press releases about the documents and provided copies to reporters. In early 1998, Pentagon officials inadvertently broadened the rebellion with a decision they made in the name of fairness. The first round of vaccinations had been given to soldiers permanently stationed in regions that faced the greatest danger of biological attack, such as the Middle East. Reservists serving less than 30 days in such areas were not included. This made no sense to Pentagon officials who had been working for several years to integrate the reserves into military operations. Why should reservists be at greater risk in an anthrax attack? And so the Pentagon issued a new policy. Anyone serving in the Middle East or South Korea, even for a few days, would have to be immunized. The directive angered reservists, particularly pilots in the Air National Guard units. Many earned a comfortable living flying for commercial airlines. Unlike their active duty colleagues, who faced court-martial for refusing the shots, they could easily quit. Some did. Others complained to their congressmen. The issue caught the eye of Chris Shays, a Republican congressman from Connecticut. Shays was an odd duck among House Republicans, a former Peace Corps volunteer and New England moderate. He had used his post as chairman of a House subcommittee to hold hearings that pounded the Pentagon for its handling of Gulf War syndrome. Shays had a good sense of how to turn complicated issues into public dramas. His Gulf War hearings had pitted ailing veterans against officials from the Pentagon and the Veterans Administration. Shays assigned a longtime aide, Larry Halloran, to investigate the case of an Air National Guardsman from Connecticut who had quit the reserves rather than be immunized. Military officials claimed that the resignation was an isolated incident, but Halloran found eight pilots from Connecticut alone who had left the Guard over the issue. His suspicions aroused, he asked the GAO to investigate the program. He also filed a request with the Pentagon for every scrap of paper in its files on the anthrax debate. The committee chairman to whom Shays reported, Representative Dan Burton of Indiana, was one of President Clinton's most visceral opponents. A darling of the conservative movement and leader of the impeachment drive then unfolding, Burton never missed a chance to embarrass the Democrats. He was also a persistent critic of childhood vaccinations, questioning whether scientists were overlooking long-term side effects. Burton was delighted to have Shays' subcommittee examine the Pentagon's anthrax vaccination program. In April 1999, at a hearing before Shays' subcommittee, the GAO announced its preliminary findings, bringing to light some of the complexities that Pentagon experts had been quietly weighing for years. Kwai Chung Chan, a GAO auditor, told the congressman that the long-term safety of the vaccine had not been studied. Therefore, one cannot conclude there are no long-term effects. Animal studies offered conflicting evidence of its efficacy against inhaled anthrax, Chan said, though it appeared the inoculations offered some protection. He told the subcommittee that the only human trials of efficacy had involved a similar but not identical version of the vaccine. Another GAO official, Sushil K. Sharma, contradicted the Defense Department's brochure on the vaccine, which said it had been safely and routinely administered in the United States to veterinarians, laboratory workers, and livestock handlers. In fact, Sharma said, the anthrax vaccine had been given to, at most, a few thousand people before 1990. General Eddie Kane, head of the Joint Program Office for Biological Defense, was sent to mount a defense. The vaccinations were going well, Kane said. Only 8 of 260,000 people receiving the vaccine had reported reactions that caused them to be hospitalized or miss more than a day of duty. The GAO offered no evidence that the vaccine was dangerous or a threat to health, but its testimony had raised some questions that did not have simple answers. Pentagon officials were shaken by the news coverage. Kane acknowledged in an email to a senior Pentagon official that the program had taken a hit. Two key areas we came up flat were GAO's assertion that, one, the anthrax vaccine licensed was not the one tested, and two, how can the Department of Defense say that reported Desert Storm illnesses were not caused by anthrax vaccine when we have no record of who received shots? If we cannot answer these questions, we, the Department of Defense and the administration, are in big-time trouble. In fact, the GAO was correct on both counts. Shays held five hearings on the anthrax issue in 1999 alone, taking more than 20 hours of testimony. Mark Zaid, the lawyer representing some of the soldiers who had refused shots, stirred more doubts when he came across documents the Army had drafted to indemnify companies making the anthrax vaccine. One document, dated September 1991, said manufacturers were entitled to special protection because of the unusually hazardous legal risks in making such a product. Lawsuits could result from adverse reactions to the vaccine or if the immunizations proved ineffective, it said. The FDA's testing of the vaccine did not involve enough people to predict what would happen when it was given to large numbers of people. Only widespread use can provide this assessment, the document said. In addition, there was no way to predict whether it would be effective against the pathogens used in a biological attack. A later version of the agreement, written specifically for the Michigan lab, made the same points. Zaid provided the memos to a reporter from the San Diego Union-Tribune, who wrote a page one story. The Pentagon played down the significance of the documents, saying they were legal precautions comparable to a homeowner buying insurance against a fire. Soldiers reading them on the Internet drew different conclusions. A month later, the Pentagon promised to conduct a long-term study of the vaccine's safety, more than a year after the first shots were administered. Pentagon officials believed they could manage the problems on Capitol Hill. But in the latter months of 1999, the program confronted a more formidable challenge. BioPort, the company that had bought the Michigan facility, was having trouble meeting the FDA's standards. If production did not resume soon, the military would not have enough vaccine to go ahead with the immunizations. But in November 1999, federal inspectors delivered another blow. The renovations to the Michigan lab had been finished in January of that year, but BioPort was still not ready to resume production. A new inspection report found more than 30 deficiencies. In December 1999, the Pentagon further slowed the vaccine program to stretch the dwindling supplies. Pentagon officials began looking at alternatives to Michigan. Some proposed building a government-owned facility, the idea that had been killed in the early years of the Clinton administration. But that would not bring any immediate relief. Officials estimated that it would take 7 years to build and license such a facility. Pentagon officials said that they hoped that BioPort would win federal approval for its production lines by the beginning of 2002, 4 years after the plant was temporarily closed for renovation. In April 2000, Burton's Committee on Government Reform released a meticulously footnoted critique entitled "The Department of Defense Anthrax Vaccine Immunization Program, Unproven Force Protection." The anthrax vaccinations, the committee concluded, were a well-intentioned but overwrought response to the threat of anthrax as a biological weapon. Gene splicing could produce new vaccine-resistant strains, making the program a medical Maginot line, a fixed fortification protecting against attack from only one direction. By some measures, the anthrax program was a success. The military had inoculated more than 500,000 troops, with only a handful reporting significant side effects. A committee of outside experts set up by the Pentagon to study the reports of adverse events found only 16 instances of serious reactions out of 1,530 reports to the FDA by mid-2001. 11 people were hospitalized for swelling of the arm near the injection site. 4 servicemen suffered systemic reactions to the vaccine, but none went into shock. 1 temporarily experienced severe lung problems that ultimately healed. According to the committee of experts, none of the illnesses persisted. The rate of adverse reactions appeared to be low, comparable to or better than those for childhood vaccines. There were no reported deaths. But the Pentagon was nonetheless unable to sell many servicemen or key members of Congress on the value of the anthrax shots. The distrust stirred by the handling of Gulf War syndrome was deepened by the initial sales pitch for the anthrax program, and critics questioned whether the voluntary reports to the FDA captured the full picture. Many servicemen, they said, were afraid to disclose their illnesses, fearing that their military careers would be harmed. The Pentagon's initial public relations strategy proved deeply flawed in an era in which every relevant document, from the scathing FDA assessments of the Michigan facility to the reports about adverse reactions, was available through the Internet. Pentagon officials dismissed the opposition to the vaccinations as Internet paranoia. But in fact, as Mark Zaid often pointed out, the most devastating questions were raised by the Pentagon's own documents. "These are not my words," he would say, brandishing a memo. "They are yours." In the years after the anthrax vaccinations began, some servicemen who had received the shots complained of dizziness, severe lethargy, and exhaustion similar to Gulf War syndrome. Government health experts believed the vaccine had not caused their illnesses. But as the Institute of Medicine made clear, more research was needed. The panel said its findings were an early step in the complex process of understanding the vaccine's safety. The effects of the controversy were clear. Hundreds of reserve pilots quit the military. By mid-2000, more than 400 servicemen had been disciplined for refusing to take the shots, and 51 had been court-martialed. A few served brief sentences in the brig. Some of the problems the Cohen team confronted in administering vaccinations against biological attack were inevitable. Doctors making the case for vaccines against dread diseases could point to measurable benefits that balanced the risks. For instance, before a measles vaccine was introduced in 1963, 500 children a year died from the illness. Deaths fell to 1 or 2 a year after children were immunized, a huge gain when compared with the tiny number of serious adverse reactions. Those advocating immunizations against biological attack could not show such clear benefits. Only the risks were certain. An otherwise healthy group of men and women received shots to protect against a health threat that might well never materialize. Other nations had calculated the risks and benefits and come to different conclusions. Britain made anthrax vaccinations for its troops voluntary. France's soldiers did not get them at all. Pentagon leaders had seriously underestimated the anthrax vaccine program's technical difficulties. Making vaccine in a tough new regulatory environment was a daunting business, as BioPort's continuing struggles showed. Stephen Joseph, the Pentagon health official, had hoped that the anthrax program would mark the beginning of a new era in which immunizations were an element of military doctrine. But the anthrax vaccination seemingly had the opposite effect. Many Pentagon officials found it hard to imagine attempting another broad immunization program against, say, botulinum toxin anytime soon. Looking back after he left the Pentagon, Richard Danzig could only shake his head. He had not understood the full dimensions of the problems at Michigan when he pressed the case for inoculations in 1995 and 1996. In hindsight, the decision to broaden the program and immunize all 2.4 million active duty and reserve troops was a much closer call. Danzig believed that his original proposal to immunize the soldiers assigned to high-threat areas would have been more popular with servicemen, and the dwindling supplies of vaccine would not have been as harmful to a less ambitious program. In the last year of the Clinton administration, federal officials geared up to assess the effectiveness of the new civil defenses. In August 2000, they staged an exercise that a press release announced would cost $3.5 million, making it the largest emergency preparedness drill ever conducted. Operation Top Off, for top officials, would test more than the ability of a large American city to respond to a germ attack. It was to be a several-day consequence management extravaganza that would involve thousands of government employees from 28 agencies. The exercise would have been even more ambitious had it not collided with financial, logistical, and political realities. The exercise was Congress's idea. In 1999, after it had appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars to train first responders in cities throughout the nation, Congress had asked the Justice Department and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in coordination with the National Security Council, to see if its investment in training and new programs was paying off. But by the time the elaborate exercise was scheduled, the novelty of tabletops and mock attacks was gone. 2 months before the drill, Attorney General Janet Reno and FEMA Director James Lee were the only two top officials committed to participating. As initially conceived, the exercise was to involve at least three cities. By the following May, the exercise had been scaled back to a covert biological attack on Denver and a chemical weapons strike in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They would keep secret the designated agents to be used, as well as the specific times and places of the attacks, to ensure an element of surprise and to make the tests as real as possible. The government's response to the hypothetical mustard gas attacks on runners at a charity foot race in Portsmouth on Saturday, May 20, 2000, was fairly effective. Though it took an exceedingly long time for the 170 victims of the bogus chemical sprayings to receive treatment, there were no riots and only limited chaos. After an FBI SWAT team stormed the fake hideout of the fake terrorist, the Group for Liberation of Orange Land and Destruction of Others, two postal workers being held hostage were released. Within 48 hours, order was restored. This, however, was not the case in Denver. The scenario opened on Wednesday night, May 17th, with a hypothetical lone terrorist release of Yersinia pestis, pneumonic plague, through the fresh air ducts of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. By Saturday, May 20th, when role-playing began, virtual victims of the attack were filling the emergency rooms of Denver Medical Health Center and two other hospitals in the area, complaining of chills, cough, fever, and other undiagnosed flu-like symptoms. By Saturday afternoon, some 500 people had checked into local hospitals for treatment. 25 of them had died. After the CDC's lab at Fort Collins confirmed that the cause of death was plague, 31 real staff members were sent to Denver to help treat the sick and dying and contain the epidemic spread. A public health emergency was declared. By late afternoon, some hospital staff were calling in sick. Antibiotics and ventilators to help people breathe were becoming scarce. Some doctors and nurses had begun wearing protective gear. The governor's office issued an order restricting travel by air, bus, and rail to and from the Denver area. The public health authorities told area residents to go to a medical facility if they felt ill or had been in contact with someone who was. Other citizens were told to stay home. By Sunday, May 21st, although the CDC had alerted neighboring states to the outbreak and its cause, cases of plague were being reported in several states, in England, and as far away as Japan. By the day's end, more than 1,800 cases of plague were reported. Almost 400 people had died. By Monday, the area's health care system was shutting down from the strain, but the city and state had still not approved a distribution plan for antibiotics. Police were worried about rioting and people stealing precious antibiotics. The medical system, government offices, and society itself were collapsing. The exercise ended on Tuesday, May 23rd, as the epidemic spread out of control. Estimates of how many people got sick and died varied widely. Some reports registered an estimated 3,700 plague cases with 950 deaths. Other participants estimated that more than 4,000 were sick and that 2,000 had died, almost twice the official death toll. A major lesson was that democracies were probably ill-prepared to make such emotionally charged decisions as whether scarce resources should be devoted to treating the sick or to trying to contain the epidemic. Top Off, showed that even well-prepared cities would be hard-pressed to do both. The Denver metropolitan area had received more than its share of emergency preparedness training. All three of the cities involved in the drill, Denver, Aurora, and Colorado Springs, were among the first 120 American cities to have been trained under the congressional program. In 1993, Denver had skillfully handled a papal visit, and in 1998, an international presidential summit and the Oklahoma City bombing trial. While state and local officials had worked fairly well together during top-off, there was tension among public health officials, hospital representatives, and the FBI. They not only inhabited different worlds, but spoke different languages. Many public health workers, for instance, were unfamiliar with and frustrated by the steady repetition of the alphabet soup of emergency preparedness. "We weren't all exactly singing Kumbaya," said Greg Moser, a counterterrorism specialist in Colorado's Office of Emergency Management. Moser and most other experts said that top-off, especially its failures, had taught them invaluable lessons. As in New York's real outbreak of West Nile virus, the endless conference calls involving up to 100 officials had been time-consuming and cumbersome. But often there was no other way to communicate. Phones in the overworked public health offices and even police stations went unmanned. Most of Denver's hospitals had no contingency plans for treating mass casualty incidents and only limited stocks of equipment, vaccines, and other drugs. Only three of Denver's 22 hospitals had been able to spend the time and money required to participate in top-off, and one of them, overwhelmed by real patient loads, had had to drop out prematurely. Few of the city's morticians had even thought about coping with such an incident. The city's decision to commandeer refrigerated trucks from the Coors Brewing Company for body storage and transport was an inspired stopgap measure, but hardly a viable solution to emotionally and politically sensitive decisions about how and where to dispose of victims' bodies. Our public health care infrastructure was in some ways better prepared in the 30s to handle an epidemic like this than they are today, said Tara O'Toole, a public health expert who evaluated the exercise. The national antibiotic stockpile, which faced its first test in top-off, passed, but barely. While the CDC sent drugs to Denver within 48 hours of the request, an impressive achievement, the plane landed at Denver International Airport, which the mayor's office was about to close. Furthermore, the drugs could not be distributed quickly. There were few workers on hand to divide the giant antibiotic push packs into manageable sizes. A public health worker went to Safeway to buy plastic bags in which the antibiotics could be distributed. The trip, top-off organizers estimated, would have taken 6 hours through streets clogged with panicked citizens. Officials complained about too many competing operations centers and not knowing who was in charge. There was also tension over making the right public health decisions and the need to make them quickly. Despite all of Denver's training, plans for isolating contagious people and getting drugs to ordinary citizens were not in place. Plans the contractors imposed, which had worked in New York, proved inappropriate for Denver. The designated points of distribution for antibiotics could serve only 140 people in an hour, utterly inadequate to the demand generated by a city of 2 million. When the exercise ended, officials were still arguing about whether a quarantine should and could be imposed on Colorado. People who hypothetically had already been confined to their homes for 72 hours were running short of food and supplies. Civil unrest was brewing. Hospitals were about to be stormed. Despite all of its previous training and drills, Denver was doomed. The disarray of top-off came as no surprise to Amy Smithson, an analyst at the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington. After 18 months of interviews with public health and emergency preparedness officials in more than 30 cities across the nation, she had concluded in the fall of 2000 that the administration's directives and Congress's new laws had produced a hodgepodge of programs that were often conceptually dubious, bureaucratically duplicative, poorly coordinated, and disastrously implemented. A Southerner who loved politics and had witnessed several national security fads come and go in her 15 years in Washington, Smithson recognized a hot new trend when she saw one. The president's personal engagement meant there would be billions of new dollars available for agencies desperate to reinvent themselves after the Cold War. Overall, the funding for counterterrorism rose from $6.5 billion in 1998 to $9.3 billion in 2001, while the part of that devoted to managing the consequences rose from $645 million in 1998 to $1.6 billion in 2001. The experts most involved in pushing for stronger defenses against biological attack knew there would be waste. The government, several said privately, was slow to move and certain to stumble as it took steps in a new direction. Even so, Smithson and some of the government's auditors felt that some of the initiatives were notably wasteful. Some of the first, most trenchant criticism came from the General Accounting Office, the congressional watchdog. In a series of reports and statements in late 1997, the GAO warned that the administration's program was based not on a rigorous assessment of the terrorist threat facing the nation, but rather on the potentially infinite vulnerability of American civilians at home and U.S. armed forces abroad. Without cogent risk and threat assessments, the GAO argued, there was no way of knowing whether the government was spending too little, too much, or just enough money fighting terrorism, much less whether the money was being spent effectively. The GAO reports underscored the singular nature of the bioterrorist threat. Despite huge investments in intelligence and readiness, there was probably no way to predict with confidence the source of an attack, its target, the agent that would be used, or therefore, how best to defend the nation. Many analysts noted that attacks using germs and unconventional weapons had been extremely rare, what national security experts termed a low-probability event. When the culprits had used or tried to use such agents, they had usually not chosen substances that would inflict mass casualties. Data collected by the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies showed that there had been 285 incidents throughout the world since 1976 in which terrorists had used chemical or biological weapons. In 44% of those cases, no one had been killed or seriously injured. In 76% of them, five or fewer people had been hurt. Examining these numbers, many analysts argued that there was little statistical support for the not if but when school of thought. However, the past might not be prologue. Statistics showed that although the number of terrorist incidents had declined in the past decade, their casualty rates had increased sharply. And America was increasingly often the target of such attacks. However low the probability of such an unconventional strike, the consequences might be so grave that any responsible government would have taken steps to protect the American people. Smithson's quarrel with Congress and the Clinton administration focused on how they had gone about it. To begin with, only $315 million of the $8.4 billion that the government spent on counterterrorism in the year 2000 was devoted to training people in cities and states to respond to a covert bioterrorism attack. Less than 4% was being spent beyond the Washington Beltway. A disproportionate share of this spending went to what public health advocates derided as the whistles and sirens, the fancy cars, faulty detectors, and other marginal gear. Only 6% of the funds to combat unconventional terrorism was allocated to strengthening the public health infrastructure, the heart of meaningful biodefense preparedness. The 1996 law that called for training of emergency personnel in the nation's 120 largest cities had proposed a simple structure. The Defense Department was in charge. But within 4 years, Smithson discovered, that statute had spawned a cottage industry of competing programs. Local officials could choose from among some 90 different courses offered by competing federal bureaucrats. The courses, moreover, differed dramatically in quality and content, but no federal office was charged with evaluating them or helping cities decide which best suited their needs. Government contractors, the so-called Beltway Bandits, were often allocated the bulk of the training money, leaving cities and states scrambling to find funds to buy protective clothing and emergency preparedness equipment. Smithson argued that the administration had shortchanged hospitals and public health in the early years. Financing for a national stockpile of vaccine and antibiotics had not begun until 1998, 2 years before the end of President Clinton's second term in office. The Department of Health and Human Services was not even included in discussions involving bioterrorism initiatives until late 1998, and it was another year before the agency had secure communications facilities in which classified information could be examined and discussed. Although they were well-intentioned, Smithson concluded the administration's homeland defense initiatives had become a triumph of political pork over preparedness. The administration's effort to reduce the threat posed by former Russian germ scientists received generally higher marks than the scattered, duplicative domestic programs, but even this effort had its problems. While in 1991, Senators Nunn and Lugar had allocated money to preventing former Soviet unconventional weapons scientists from selling their arms or lethal expertise to rogue states or terrorists, the Clinton administration did not provide serious money for biological defense until years after the program was begun. At the State Department, funds for the Biological Nonproliferation Programs, the Moscow-based International Science and Technology Center, and other scientific exchange and cooperation projects with former Soviet bioweaponeers were reduced year after year as a result of budget battles between and within the executive and legislative branches. By 2000, annual State Department support for such projects reached a total of $12 million, its highest level, but still a pittance compared to major government efforts. The same was true at the Energy Department. Most of its nonproliferation funds went to Russian nuclear cities and programs. Very little was spent on biology. Although Russian scientists had repeatedly warned the administration that Iranian officials were hunting for experts, particularly those with recombinant skills involving plant and animal pathogens, the Department of Agriculture received funding for anti-bioterrorism programs only in 1999. And for 2 years in a row, either the administration's Office of Management and Budget or Congress had rejected the Agriculture Department's request for $70 million to expand and upgrade its own Animal Pathogen Research and Diagnostic Center on New York's Plum Island. There was no shortage of funding or congressional support for the Pentagon's effort to create rapid reaction teams within the National Guard. By January 2001, more than $143 million had been invested in the project, which was racing ahead on an accelerated schedule. In their 1998 memo to Cohen outlining the concept, Army experts had said it would take 3 years to train and equip the new units, an exceptionally quick turnaround for such a sophisticated mission. Army officials overseeing the Guard program set an even shorter timetable and planned to have the first 10 teams ready for action by the end of 2000. In a bow to civil liberties concerns, the Pentagon had dropped the hard-charging acronym for the teams, RAID, for Rapid Assessment and Initial Detection, in favor of a much blander moniker. The new name, Civil Support Teams, was chosen to convey the Guard's subordinate role to civilians. In January 2001, the Department of Defense's Inspector General delivered an independent assessment of the project. It depicted an unmitigated catastrophe. The government's inspector generals are assigned the thankless task of auditing and reviewing the efficacy of federal programs. They are independent, and President Ronald Reagan once said he wanted them to be as mean as junkyard dogs. Most of the auditors are decorous in their criticism, their language restrained. The report on the National Guard initiative was unusually scathing, as damning an internal assessment as the Pentagon has ever made public. The Inspector General concluded that the office setting up the program had so mismanaged the effort that it should be disbanded. Despite the years of work and training, none of the 10 teams was ready to be sent anywhere. Because of management blunders, defective and inappropriate equipment, and poor training, the units that were supposed to be deployable by January 2000 might themselves be at risk in an urban catastrophe, the auditors found. Only 5 of the 10 teams had recruited all of their 22 members, and many of the members had not been able to participate in training exercises. Each team still needed some protective clothing. 9 of the 10 could not talk with headquarters because of lack of communications equipment. Only 2 teams had been given handheld equipment to detect biological agents. When they conducted their initial exercises, none had received the mobile labs containing the equipment needed to identify a potential germ agent. When the vans with this equipment, each unit costing $1.6 million, the cornerstone of the project, finally arrived, some of their air filters were installed backward. Each van was supposed to contain a glove box, a sealed compartment for examining a biological agent. But because the boxes were badly designed and too big, there was too little room for team members to work in the vans. Many team members, moreover, had no idea how to use or maintain the glove boxes, which arrived without manuals. The gas masks provided to the teams had never been tested and were equipped with incompatible parts. While the masks and the accompanying blowers probably would have worked when assembled, one team commander told the auditors, "I'm just not willing to bet my life on it." During training exercises, some teams were issued partially filled air tanks to supply their masks and had to get refills from local firemen, which made the guardsmen a burden to the people they were sent to assist. Microscopes turned out to be too large to be installed in the vans, and their attachments required 5 electrical outlets. The vans had only 3. As a result, the auditors said, many team members and their commanders, whom the report described as dedicated, highly motivated people committed to their missions, were demoralized. The inspectors noted that the commanders and their team members lacked confidence in the unknown, untested, and unsubstantiated reliability of the equipment that they were issued, not to mention the program's managers. The Pentagon did not dispute the report's findings and moved to shut down the office managing the project even before it was officially filed. Charles L. Cragen, an acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs, charged with overseeing the National Guard, said in early 2001 that his organization was working with great perseverance to resolve the problems identified by the auditors and that many had already been fixed. Cragen blamed the failures on the pressure the Guard had been under to mount so many sophisticated teams for a complex mission so quickly. Guard officials said the technical problems had been largely resolved and that the civil support teams would soon be ready to carry out their mission. Another weakness in America's biodefenses was the continuing failure to produce a cheap, reliable detector that would sound the alarm if a germ attack was underway. The military had been trying to build such devices since the early days of America's offensive program. What the Pentagon wanted was a simple device like a smoke detector that could sniff the air and quickly identify a bug in a biological attack. Some progress had been made since the Gulf War, when commanders were startled to learn that they had nothing effective to warn them. But the detectors were still rudimentary, and the stakes were rising. In the early 1990s, officials planning America's defenses against germ attack envisioned a crucial role for biodetectors. If the public health authorities knew immediately that their city had been attacked, they could begin evacuations, quarantines, and treatments. But for the moment, the American people were the nation's main means of detecting biological attack. The Clinton effort initially focused on projects mainly for the military. The Pentagon had tested a truck-mounted lab to sniff the air, an airplane to track particulate clouds, and an electronic network at military bases that tied together many sensors to double-check results and lower the number of false alerts. All had serious flaws. In September 2000, the Pentagon's Inspector General criticized one of the more costly efforts. The Joint Biological Point Detection System, which used some of the most advanced technology, was developed by Lockheed Martin. By 2000, the company had begun to build the first installment of 970 detectors in a $1 billion program. but the Inspector General concluded that the prototype machine achieved only one of its 10 critical goals. It broke down repeatedly and often failed to identify lethal pathogens. Lockheed insisted it had done the best it could given the difficulty of the technical challenge. Frustrated by the lack of progress, military planners eventually turned to the weapons laboratories that had invented the atomic and hydrogen bombs. In the 1990s, these labs had found new work by addressing threats of mass destruction, especially germ weapons. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, a square mile of federal science in central California, threw itself into the detector push. Zeroing in on genes, it sought to identify the most unambiguous signatures of microbial individuality, just as Venter had suggested to President Clinton at the Renaissance weekend dinner. First, the lab developed a means of mapping a microbe's genetic material with the same kind of equipment that was being used to decode the human genome. These signatures were then copied into artificially made snippets of DNA. When these snippets were mixed with a candidate germ that had been unraveled, say, anthrax, the snippet would bind to the germ's genetic material, causing a bit of fluorescent dye to float free. Under proper illumination, the sample glowed. Livermore then miniaturized its invention, reducing a huge mass of tubes, bottles, and electronic parts to a device that could fit in a suitcase or a handheld detector. By 1999, the lab had perfected a small chamber with a silicon chip that, theoretically, could identify germs in 7 minutes. By 2001, it was packaged as HANA, for Handheld Advanced Nucleic Acid Analyzer. Weighing 2 pounds, powered by batteries, highly computerized, HANA underwent field trials at several sites, including the CDC in Atlanta, the FDA, and Los Angeles County's Emergency Operations Office. Livermore announced that it would transfer its invention to a company that would make and sell the detectors. The small device was promising, but further testing was needed to determine if it was really a breakthrough. The election of George Bush in the fall of 2000 raised questions about whether the cooperative programs between American and Russian scientists could survive. A review by the new administration gave the effort a qualified blessing, but problems persisted on both sides of the partnership. There was no shortage in Russian political circles of critics who opposed closer dealings with America, and not just within Russia. Some officials in the Uzbek and Kazakh governments had also tried to undercut the cooperative threat reduction program by being less than cooperative on requirements that Congress and the Clinton administration had imposed. Despite quiet American pleadings, the Kazakhs by mid-2001 had still not ratified the treaty banning biological weapons. Uzbekistan, until the spring of 2001, had delayed signing an umbrella agreement under which cooperative assistance projects operated. But compared to Russia, and despite occasional setbacks, the programs with the Central Asian states had made significant progress. In Washington, the gnawing suspicion that American aid was enabling Russia to do research that might benefit a weapons program continued to hinder the program. Weber himself had experienced disappointments that had given ammunition to critics of the program, and both the former Soviet institutes and the United States were to blame. Military labs were still closed to Americans. At the Stepnogorsk complex, which Weber had dreamed of transforming into the poster child for nonproliferation, the joint venture to manufacture pharmaceuticals collapsed before it got off the ground. A $3 million contract was canceled in 1997. Only $2 million of it was recovered. A plan to make disposable syringes in the former germ plant also collapsed the following year when production stopped because of unpaid utility bills. Another plan to sterilize up to 2 million syringes in yet another part of the complex failed because of inadequate financing and a shortage of cobalt-60, a radioactive isotope used to kill germs. However, the Pentagon was systematically dismantling the plant. By the summer of 2000, the massive fermenters had been removed and melted down for scrap metal. All equipment that could be used for making germ weapons had been destroyed. Filtration systems that once kept contaminated air inside the labs had been ripped out and were stacked high in piles of debris outside the production buildings. That year, Kazakhstan and the Defense Department had decided to raise the buildings. But negotiations had stalled over the price. While the plant no longer posed a threat, the same could not be said of its scientists and engineers. The Pentagon had helped destroy their life's work, but had given them almost nothing to take its place. There was no more work at the plant itself. The small, well-equipped toxicology lab that Washington had paid $750,000 to help open employed about 60 former germ warriors in downtown Stepnogorsk. Hundreds more needed jobs. The town's population had shrunk by half, and unemployment was still rampant. Weber and other American officials argued that the United States should do more to ensure that the weapons scientists who had made anthrax would be able to find peaceful work, hopefully in Kazakhstan. But the idea had little support in Congress, which preferred to invest money in dismantling dangerous facilities. In fact, the physical infrastructure of death was mostly gone. What remained unsolved was the more vexing problem of how to keep scientists from selling their expertise to Iran or elsewhere. Conclusion. Is the threat of germ weapons real or exaggerated? Our answer is both. At key points in recent years, senior officials overstated the danger of biological attack, harming their cause with hyperbole. In most conditions, a 5-pound bag of anthrax could kill many people, but not as many as half the inhabitants of Washington, D.C. Similarly, political leaders undermined their credibility by asserting that a biological attack against the United States was inevitable in the next few years, a matter of not if, but when. No such certainty exists. Germ weapons played a minor role in 20th century warfare and terrorism when scientists invented new means of slaughter on an industrial scale, from atomic bombs to gas chambers. Yet most nations chose not to use the germ weapons when they went to war. Terrorists have blown up buildings, hijacked scores of airplanes, and murdered indiscriminately in the past 3 decades. Only a handful of groups have attempted biological attacks, and fewer still have succeeded. Thus far, the Rajneeshis germ assault on the citizen of the Dalles, Oregon, in 1984 has proven to be an anomaly. Nonetheless, we conclude that the threat of germ weapons is real and rising, driven by scientific discoveries and political upheavals around the world. As Aum Shinrikyo's failed efforts suggest, the crucial ingredient in a successful biological attack is not advanced laboratory equipment or virulent microbes alone, but knowledge. Such expertise is increasingly available. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, thousands of scientists skilled in biological warfare found themselves unemployed or penniless. The demise of South Africa's apartheid system and Iraq's defeat in the Gulf War have also added to the talent pool from which weapons scientists can be recruited. Drugs and vaccines are now made throughout the world, giving many nations the ability to manufacture germ weapons. It took the United States and the Soviet Union more than a decade of trial and error to master the secrets in the 1950s. 3 decades later, Iraqi scientists learned how to make thousands of gallons of anthrax and botulinum in just a few years. The contrast to nuclear weapons illustrates why many call germ weapons the poor man's atom bomb. A nation that obtains plans for a crude nuclear device is at the beginning of a complex technical challenge that requires staggering, easily detectable investments in mines, factories, and nuclear reactors. But scientists like Bill Patrick or Ken Alabeck say they could teach a terrorist group how to make devastating germ weapons from a few handfuls of backyard dirt and some widely available lab equipment. The emergence of the United States as the world's most powerful nation has made biological attack more likely. Adversaries that resent America's global dominance, envy its wealth, or fear its overwhelming military power can fight back most effectively with unconventional weapons. The attack on the USS Cole in October 2000 showed how the seemingly powerless can strike a devastating military blow. A modern warship was crippled and nearly sunk by a dinghy packed with explosives and detonated by suicide bombers. In the coming years, those willing to die for their cause may well choose instead to become smallpox carriers or Marburg martyrs. The pace of scientific advance has also intensified the germ threat. Cohen and Boyer's pioneering work a quarter century ago helped give scientists new tools to improve crops and cure disease. But genetic manipulation can also be exploited to disorient, maim, and kill. No one can predict the recombinant future. But for now, it appears that the genetic revolution may produce few killers of the sort found in the Cobra event, few agents such as brain pox. In real life, the most likely danger is that classic agents, the so-called oldie moldies, will be turned into custom pathogens that can defeat drugs, antidotes, and vaccines. The spread of recombinant knowledge through scientific exchanges and commerce has given even modestly skilled scientists the means to create havoc. In a decade or two, terrorists may no longer need to hire their own germ experts. The threat is magnified by a unique feature of germ weapons, uncertainty. Explosive bombs leave few doubts about their toll, but in a biological attack, city officials would not immediately know the source and nature of the outbreak or the true number of victims. The authorities would be forced to assume the worst, Josh Lederberg has argued, and strive to protect as many people as possible, inevitably deepening panic. The world's response to the growing dangers of germ weapons has fallen far short of what is needed. The 1972 treaty was a useful step, cementing an international consensus that this class of weapons is morally heinous. The subsequent conduct of the Soviet Union, Iraq, and South Africa, all of which signed the pact and then flagrantly violated it, underscores its inherent weaknesses. We believe that the recent effort to strengthen the treaty by providing some means of enforcement should be pursued. A balance can be struck between the need to protect legitimate research and the imperative of investigating suspected cheaters. The world's experience with Iraq clearly shows the limits of international inspections, but there is merit in reinforcing the moral taboos associated with germ weapons, as well as in raising the practical and political costs of building biological bombs. Leading scientists have quietly begun debating whether genetic engineers and other practitioners of the new biology should adopt their own version of the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. Such a step, while mostly symbolic, would help researchers become more sensitive to the ethical consequences of their work. In recent years, the world's nations have created international tribunals to prosecute war crimes. We believe the weight of international law should be brought to bear on those who traffic in biological weapons, as Matthew Messelson and others have suggested. Closer international cooperation is also needed to limit the sales of deadly pathogens by germ banks. The United States wisely tightened its rules on such sales in 1996 after a right-wing survivalist attempted to buy plague germs from the American Type Culture Collection, the same company that had sold anthrax to Iraq in the late 1980s. We recognize that the global fight against infectious diseases requires the free exchange of dangerous germs among scientists, but once again, a balance must be struck. Each nation should also enact tougher laws, as the United States has done. Ma Anand Shila, a leader of the Rajneeshi cult convicted on charges of assault, attempted murder, arson, and poisoning hundreds of people in Oregon, was released from prison in 1988 after serving only 29 months. Shila subsequently moved to Switzerland and began a new career as a nursing home operator. Today, the punitive measures that Congress passed mean such a crime would likely earn a much longer sentence. The Clinton administration made a real effort to confront the germ threat. Several of its initiatives deserve praise. After visiting facilities like Vector and Stepnogorsk, we conclude that the benefits of cooperative programs with the former Soviet Union far outweigh the potential dangers. Such programs, of course, have their risks. Some American officials believe that Russia's military is still making germ weapons at laboratories that remain closed to outsiders. And Moscow has continued to lie about its past biological efforts, even in the face of irrefutable evidence. But the gains of cooperation have been substantial. Intelligence officials acknowledge that much of what they have learned about the former Soviet program came from the open scientific exchanges arranged by Andy Weber and other officials. In April 2001, Weber and his colleagues were the first Westerners to visit a scientific institute in Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan, a previously unknown corner of the Soviet germ empire where scientists developed biological weapons to infect livestock. Such scientific exchanges build relationships that cross borders, creating constraints even for authoritarian governments. As Dave Franz, the former head of germ defense at Fort Detrick, points out, a Russia in which key scientists correspond regularly by email with their Western counterparts will be less able to sustain a covert germ weapons program. The Clinton administration's belated investments in public health, basic research, disease surveillance, and stockpiling of antidotes make sense. They are likely to save lives even if the United States never faces a germ attack. Even so, America in some ways is less prepared today for an outbreak of deadly disease than it was a half century ago. The largest hospital in the Dalles, Oregon, had 125 beds when the Rajneeshis struck in 1984. Today, it has 49. Some public health clinics lack microscopes, let alone computers or access to the internet. New York's experience with West Nile virus demonstrated the crucial role of the public health system in detecting and countering a germ outbreak, however it originates. A positive step would be the development of computerized systems that help epidemiologists track novel infectious diseases. There was significant waste in the Clinton years. Biological defense turned into an entitlement program for federal agencies, private contractors, and government consultants. While many projects were well-intentioned, the administration failed to give any single official the authority to eliminate duplications, enforce discipline, and direct the money to where it would do the most good. Although the president delivered two major addresses on the dangers of biological warfare, the administration never marshaled its resources to strengthen the germ treaty or to promote a coherent program of biodefense. Distracted by impeachment, the administration's attention to these issues was intense but episodic, a poor recipe for explaining a complex problem to the American people. It took Richard Danzig more than a year to persuade the Pentagon's commanders, an unusually well-informed group, to step up their responses to the germ threat. No one should expect Congress or the public to be more easily swayed. Programs like compulsory anthrax vaccinations must be explained in detail and candidly. The same is true of the intelligence agency's efforts to counter germ warfare. The 1972 treaty permits almost any kind of research in the name of defense. Some of this work is unquestionably justifiable. Other research edges closer to the blurriest of lines. We can imagine defensive research that a nation might legitimately keep secret, such as experiments exploring the vulnerabilities of existing vaccines. But American officials should disclose the existence of such research and its general outlines whenever possible. Few secrets are kept forever in a democracy, and the revelation of research into superbugs or the building of germ bomblets inevitably stirs deeper suspicions. The United States undermines the treaty it helped create and its own moral authority when it cloaks the most significant aspects of its defensive work in secrecy. The experts who met with President Clinton in 1998 urged him to create a panel of experts who would provide an independent assessment of this secret work. While the CIA during the Clinton administration did create such a committee, it met infrequently and lacked the clout, access, and mandate to review programs that were spread throughout the government. We believe that the experts were right. Such a committee with real powers of oversight would build confidence at home and abroad in America's biological agenda. A half century ago, a group of eminent citizens warned James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, that the United States was defenseless against germ attacks. But its recommendations for better intelligence, more research, drug stockpiles, and medical surveillance systems were largely ignored. Over the next 5 decades, a series of American presidents confronted the problem, considered various remedies, and shuffled the issue into the too hard box. Such denial is understandable. Biodefense has no natural political constituency in Washington. The military-industrial complex that supports weapons systems has little interest in vaccines and public health. Plans should be prepared for the establishment of adequate laboratory and vaccine production facilities and stockpiles of essential basic medical supplies in the event the danger from enemy attack appears imminent, Forrestal's committee concluded in 1949. Prompt action should be taken to establish a civil defense program. Those words could have been written yesterday. The question is whether the United States will be able to wait another 50 years to act on them. If we as a nation believe that the germ threat is a hoax, we are spending too much money on it. But if the danger is real, as we conclude it is, then the investment is much too haphazard and diffuse. We remain woefully unprepared for a calamity that would be unlike any this country has ever experienced.
Germs, Biological Weapons and America's Secret War was written by Judith Miller, Stephen Engelberg, and William Broad, and read by Murphy Geyer. It was abridged for audio by Jan Werner. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Jessica Cassidy. Germs, Biological Weapons and America's Secret War was produced and directed by Sally Hurst. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Germs, Biological Weapons and America's Secret War is also available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.